The second issue is, assuming that this Court is not willing to overrule existing Wisconsin law on the subject, is the statement at issue in this case admissible or inadmissible under current law? With respect to the first question, should existing law be overruled, the first order of business, I think, is to determine exactly what is the existing law. And I think that that is to be found in two cases, which I think complement one another and simply establish the law and the present law in slightly different terminology, but provide exactly the same substance to it. The first is the only case in which this Court has ever, or any Wisconsin appellate court in a published decision, has ever found a statement made in the wake of a polygraph examination, in a post-polygraph interview, to be inadmissible. And that's the case which I'm never quite sure how to pronounce, but I'll pronounce it Schleiss. Could be Schleiss, it could be Schleese. I'll be pronouncing it Schleiss. State versus Schleiss, which is at 86 with second. And there, in describing why this Court was finding the post-polygraph statement to be inadmissible, said, the post-mechanical interview was so closely associated with the mechanical or electrical testing, both as to time and content, that it must be considered as one event, and because of the lack of a Stanislavski stipulation, in other words, a stipulation that would have permitted the admissibility of the test results, it must be excluded from evidence. So the test established there is whether or not that post-polygraph interview during which the statement was given is really considered to be one event with the actual polygraph mechanical testing. In a later decision, State versus Dean, where this Court overruled Stanislavski and indicated that it was no longer going to allow the admissibility of polygraph test results, whether or not there was a stipulation, this Court took note of the four cases, including Schleiss, in which the question of the admissibility of post-polygraph statements had been raised. In the other three, they were all found to be admissible. And this Court stated the following with regard to, summed up the following with regard to the test for admissibility. And I'll just read, it's two sentences. Actually, it's one sentence with a semicolon in between. And it indicated both sides of the coin. If the defendant's statement was part of the polygraph examination, it was not admissible because there was no stipulation. If the defendant's statement was part of an interrogation and not part of the polygraph examination, the admissibility of the statement is governed by the usual rules governing admissibility of confessions. So that's the present state of the law in Wisconsin with regard to the admissibility of statements made in post-polygraph interviews. Is the interview part of the examination? Is the interview so closely connected that it and the examination can be considered one event? That law is, as best I can tell, contrary to all other jurisdictions in this country. The trial court in this case noted that. It expressly said that, as far as it was aware, Wisconsin stands alone in taking that sort of approach to statements made as part of polygraph examinations. There is a ALR notation which I cite in my brief, which sums up the law in other jurisdictions, and says, as a general rule, the courts have held that the mere fact that the accused confessed to a particular crime in anticipation of, during, or following a polygraph examination does not in itself render the confession inadmissible in evidence. That's contrary to what this Court, the rule adopted by this Court in Schleiss and described in Dean. So we start off, I think, with significant question raised as to the validity of the current rule, since it is so out of step with the rule in other jurisdictions. So I think the way we have to decide whether or not the rule deserves to be retained is to ask ourselves whether or not there is a defensible rationale for the rule. Based on existing case law, the only rationale I can see, if you can call it a rationale, is that because test results are inadmissible, any statements made in conjunction with the administration of the tests should also be held inadmissible. And as I point out in my brief, that rationale simply does not hold water. We exclude polygraph test results because they are because there are significant questions as to the reliability. And while we thought we had managed to deal with those through the Stanislavski requirements, where this court required a stipulation and then added additional safeguards, including instructing the jury, including the judge making a review to determine whether stipulated test results should be admissible, this court decided after some experience with Stanislavski, this court decided in the Dean decision that those safeguards simply weren't sufficient to assure that the integrity of the trial process and the reliability of the test results, and therefore return to an absolute ban on the admission of polygraph test results. Those same concerns do not transfer into statements made during the course of the polygraph examination. There's no question about scientific reliability. Assuming, as we must and as occurred in this case, a judge makes a finding that the statement is voluntary, then there should be no concern about the integrity of the trial process. So the concerns that have led to the rule banning the admission of polygraph test results simply have no application whatsoever to the question of the admissibility of a statement. So I suggest to you that since you seem to be completely out of step with case law in other jurisdictions, and since the only rationale that is discernible on the face of the present Wisconsin decisions dealing with the subject simply cannot justify the rule that's been adopted, that rule should be overruled.
Mr. Becker, let's assume that the defendant wants to get into the credibility or trustworthiness of the statement that's being offered, and that statement was made during the course of a polygraph exam. Isn't the defendant somewhat restricted in terms of being able to get into the circumstances? Is the defendant going to be able to develop that this all occurred during a polygraph exam, and here's what was being asked, and here's what I was answering? Would that be appropriate, do you think?
On that point, I don't think there is any disagreement between opposing counsel and myself. The answer to your question is the defense counsel or the defendant would be allowed to get into those circumstances. There is a substantial body of case law on this subject. Opposing counsel cited an ALR annotation. I cited one of many cases I could have cited because I was simply agreeing with defense counsel, and I think it appears in a footnote in my reply brief. But there are other cases besides the one that I cited. I think probably most of them will be found in that annotation that is cited by opposing counsel. And what those cases say, what they make very clear is, because they come from jurisdictions where, like Wisconsin, you, as a general proposition, you are not allowed to get into the fact that a polygraph was taken, and in particular that you can't get into what the results of the test may have been. And those jurisdictions, most of them look to a U.S. Supreme Court decision called Crane versus Kentucky, in which the court ruled that you cannot keep a defendant from getting into the circumstances surrounding the giving of confession at trial, even after the court has considered all those circumstances in determining voluntariness. The U.S. Supreme Court said, but there's also then a question for the jury with respect to the reliability of those statements that goes beyond voluntariness, and that, of course, is the rule in Wisconsin. And you cannot keep a defendant from going into those circumstances. So a defendant has a constitutional right to get into those circumstances, but it's under the control of the defendant. The state cannot anticipate that. The state cannot, as part of its case, bring in the anything related to the polygraph, but the defendant can.
Doesn't that present somewhat of a dilemma, though, for the defendant? Because once you start talking about this all occurred during a polygraph exam, isn't the concern that the jury is going to want to know what the results were, what happened? Was he lying or not?
Yeah, and of course, this is what is raised by opposing counsel, this so-called, and I think to some extent it is a Hobson's choice. I think there's an answer to it, but this problem the defendant has, and I think we can present the problem more starkly yet than you have presented it, and that is that what about the case such as this one apparently is, at least according to the trial court's fact-finding, where the defendant is told, affirmatively told, you failed the test, and the defendant says, that is what prompted me to make my give my confession, and it also is a factor that I think you jurors should consider in determining just how reliable it is, because my will was overborne by, you know, I'm not sure if that circumstance alone would be sufficient to, and in fact, the case law is pretty clear that that fact alone certainly does not render the statement involuntary, and whether a jury would find from that alone that there's some question about reliability, I don't know, but there may well be cases where that factor in combination with other factors certainly needs to be examined by the jury in determining whether the statement is in fact reliable, the defendant contending that if not by itself in combination with other factors, it in fact rendered my statement unreliable, you shouldn't trust it. It was given when I was told that I had failed the polygraph exam. So then you are presented very starkly with what my opponent has labeled a Hobson's choice. Does the defendant, as would be the defendant's right, under the rule that I have said is adopted in other jurisdictions, that the defendant can keep the jury from hearing anything about the polygraph by simply refraining from introducing evidence on it, because the State is not allowed, the rule banning polygraph evidence would keep the State from introducing that evidence. So does the defendant do that and keep the jury from hearing this somewhat damning evidence that the defendant has been informed that he failed the polygraph, or does the defendant give up that, and does the defendant introduce evidence, the evidence, so as to test the reliability of a statement, but at the same time he's testing the reliability of a statement, he produces this very prejudicial evidence. And I don't question that there is that tension. And the question I think for this Court is whether or not what I have suggested in my reply brief as the answer to that so-called Hobson's choice is a sufficient one. And I have suggested that the way we deal with this is the way that it has been dealt with in cases that I cited in my brief, where the Court gives a limiting instruction informing the jury as to the limited purpose for which they heard this evidence regarding the polygraph examination and perhaps heard evidence that the defendant was informed that he had failed the test. And I will candidly admit that I am not one that is very skeptical of limiting instructions as an abstract matter. I don't think telling a jury disregard the elephant that's sitting there in the courtroom is going to probably do much good. And I think in many cases I'm probably more skeptical than perhaps the courts have been, because the law is that we presume, and boy, you said this, and the Court of Appeals has said this over and over again, that the law presumes the jury follows instructions. But I'm not ready here to rely on just the presumption that jury follows instructions. I think we should look at this particular situation and ask whether or not we can be confident that a limiting instruction will, in fact, do the job. And so that for skeptics like myself, and like I said, maybe more skeptical than at least is reflected in the Court's decisions, where there is this presumption that we think limiting instructions do the job, whether or not my skepticism can be overcome. And I think it can be, because, first of all, this is not a situation as in the Stanislavski era where we introduced all of the, I mean, you know, there's some question raised in Dean about just how much an instruction can solve the problem in the Stanislavski era where we admitted the evidence and then told the jurors that they should that it was up to them to decide how much weight to give to it. And this Court indicated that, and quoting from other jurisdictions, indicated that once they're presented with this whole panoply, the full description of the polygraph process, and they hear the examiner's testimony and his conclusions and his testimony perhaps about how reliable the tests are and like that, and things like that, that it's very difficult in those circumstances for the jury then to not perhaps give due weight to the polygraph test results. But in this situation, we would not be hearing any of this kind of evidence. The defendant would not be adducing the polygraph examiner To lay out the test results and how he went through the tracings and how what the defense reactions were and how reliable these tests are and that kind of thing. All we would be hearing would be testimony from the defendant, perhaps from a witnessing officer, that the defendant was told that he had failed the polygraph examination. And I think when that's all the testimony that's before the jury, I think that an instruction to the jury that doesn't simply say, well, ignore that testimony, but explains why they're to ignore it, explains the limited purpose for which it's admitted on the question of reliability, that they are not to conclude from that that the defendant was in fact lying, that in fact such a conclusion would be contrary to law which views polygraph test results with great skepticism and does not find them to be sufficiently reliable to be admissible in a court of law. I think that when the jury is given that, I think that that can go a long way, if not all the way, to obviating any prejudice that may have resulted. And if that isn't enough, I think there's some frosting that can be put on the cake that really takes care of the problem, and that is this. What they will have heard is that a polygraph examiner told the defendant that he failed the test. They will not have, I think in the usual case and probably in any case, have heard from the polygraph examiner that in fact that was his conclusion. And I think you can tell the jury that what you heard was a statement, what you heard was that the defendant was told this. You have not heard any evidence as to whether or not he in fact failed the test.
Can you tell them that sometimes police officers lie?
I think that would be implicit in what I just suggested you tell them. And if not, you can go that far. Police officers, if the polygraph examiner happens to be a police officer, the polygraph examiner sometimes lies.
Here it was a police officer, wasn't it?
Here it was, and I think in a lot of cases. But I think you could. I would rather have us. I think what we've got to remember here is that we've got exceedingly critical and strong evidence that we're talking about excluding here because of the so-called Hobbs's choice, namely a confession has been found to be voluntary.
All right. Counsel?
Yeah.
Do you have any evidence of studies or public opinion polls or otherwise about the public's view of polygraphs, that they are good or they're not, that they're reliable or they're not?
I don't know. I thought about that question, I think last night as I was musing about this case in my own mind. And the only thing that came to my mind, and I don't know whether it reflects the public at large, and I don't remember how much the public recalls this, but my mind went back to the Nixon impeachment hearings and Senator Sam Irwin. And Senator Irwin said, 20th century witchcraft. Now, I don't know if Sam Irwin was, I don't suppose Sam Irwin was completely reflecting the public view. But I'm not so sure that...
Let me answer the question, or at least raise it. Apparently, members of the public think it has some value because you can give tests, I think, under the statute in employment situations.
Yes.
So, obviously, people for their everyday lives are relying on it.
Well,
and people...
I don't know how many people, though, are involved in that kind of situation. I mean,
employers can do that, so you've got a lot of employees' potential.
But I don't know how often it's actually done.
Okay. And the legislature obviously thinks it's okay in those circumstances, so one might assume they reflect the public.
Yeah. But let's assume the worst case, that at least... Starting out, a person has a favorable view of polygraph and its efficacy. I still think that you can tell the jurors in no uncertain terms that is not the view that the law takes in a court of law, that they are not considered reliable.
I have another question.
Go ahead.
And that is, I think the state should argue, maybe you are, that this is just the ordinary course of trickery and deceit and that the police use all the time to get a confession.
Well, first of all, I don't know that there was trickery and deceit here.
We don't know that there wasn't, because we don't know what the results are, right?
No, we didn't.
So you just said that the jury can assume that he passed.
Well, I think what you tell the jury is they should not speculate as to whether or not he did or did not pass.
So you shouldn't speculate either, or I. But at least one of the possibilities is that there's trickery. Now, there are loads of cases that say you can trick a defendant, right?
Yeah. Yes.
So isn't that your position here? You can trick a defendant.
Well, I think our position is more broad than that, but it encompasses that, and that is our position ultimately is that and is simply that we ought to apply to these statements made in the wake of a polygraph examination the same test we normally apply, which is the test of voluntariness.
Now, this case involves after polygraph. You're looking for a bigger and better rule of during polygraph, too, aren't you?
Absolutely. What I'm saying,
I just
want
to know it.
Yeah, I think how the present rule, how I highlighted what I think is the absurdity of the present rule is that I don't think there's any question that under the present rule, if it's during the polygraph, statements would be excluded. And so what you could potentially have is a fellow that is hooked up to the polygraph machine. Maybe he answers a few of those introductory questions that are designed to set the baseline, and now the polygraph examiner moves to the critical questions about, well, were you there that night, and did you put the gun in the victim's ribs and ask for his money? And at that point, the defendant says, I guess you're going to find out anyway, and answers the question truthfully. Yes, I was. You're going to find out anyway. I know that I'm not going to be able to fool the machine.
You make the assumption that all confessions are truthful.
Well, I did for purposes of
but they're not.
He makes a statement admitting, scratch the word truthfulness from what I said earlier, he makes a statement admitting that he, in fact, is guilty. Why should that statement be found? And it's clearly voluntary, although I think I posed my hypothetical in my brief. Let's suppose he's just hooked up to the machine, no questions are asked, and he blurts it out even before the first question is asked. I'm going to flunk this test. You're going to find out anyway. I'm going to tell you I did the crime. Now, whether he's telling the truth or not, I mean, that's a separate issue, I guess, as Justice Abramson has indicated. But let's say he says that. This is not just a voluntary statement. This is a volunteered statement, I would suggest. And I think, under the present rule, would definitely exclude it because it was part of the polygraph examination. You can't justify excluding that kind of a statement.
Well, one of the interesting things is about the warnings or the statement given in before he takes the polygraph. Nowhere in this is he told that the polygraph test results cannot be used in a court of law. Nowhere does it say that.
That's correct.
That's correct. Indeed, the implication is it can be. Because it says, I do hereby authorize the Milwaukee Police Department to disclose both orally and in writing the exam results and opinions to the Milwaukee County DA's office. Now, why would you do that unless the DA was going to use that evidence? I mean, the implication is he can be anything he says and the results can be used against him, and yet that's just not the correct statement of law at that time.
Yeah.
Now, it might be when this court issues its decision, but it's not at that time. And it's not correct, I don't think, under Schleiss, that you can use statements during the polygraph against him if you can't use statements afterwards that are related.
Well, I agree with that. I agree with that latter.
Right.
But no, I agree with your latter.
Well, they're just misstating the law to him.
Well,
what kind of statement's that?
First of all, I'm not ready to say that
Well, isn't it true, Mr. Becker, that there's a full Mirandization that precedes every polygraph in paragraph 2 of the form?
Exactly. And that's what Justice Abramson is saying, though misinforms a defendant in this context because the statements given during the polygraph are not going to be admitted against him.
That's right.
But then I would still say to you then let's throw all of that in deciding whether or not the statement was voluntary. The statement he ultimately gives was voluntary. If he was misinformed as to the if somehow, first of all, I don't think telling him that the test results are going to be disclosed to the DA's office necessarily is telling him that they're going to be admissible in court, because they could be disclosed to the DA's office simply for charging purposes.
I know, but they never say it's not admissible.
No.
But, I mean, the whole implication here is we
right.
gotcha.
Okay. But then let's focus. Let's throw that into the mix. Let's set the test for the admissibility of statements as voluntariness, and then let us ask how this misinformation, if indeed there was misinformation, impacted on voluntariness. I'm more than willing to do that, but I want the ultimate. I want these statements to be judged the same way we judge all other statements, and we judge all other statements by throwing those kinds of things into the hopper and asking whether or not they contributed to overbearing the defendant's will.
What was the state's purpose here? The state's purpose here was not investigation anymore. The state's purpose here was to get a confession. That was the whole point of all this questioning.
I don't agree with the dichotomy between investigation on the one hand and getting a confession on the other. I think getting a confession is an investigative purpose and, as the case law teaches, a perfectly legitimate one. Now, my opponent has been able to cite one case from one jurisdiction that suggests otherwise, but
what
I suggest. Which one is that?
Montana.
Yes. Is it?
Okay.
Yeah,
that's Craig.
Craig. Yes. I've shepherdized that case. It's not been cited outside of Montana except in one decision, and not for that proposition. And as I cited in my brief, there are all kinds of cases that say telling a guy that he failed a test is a perfectly legitimate investigative technique designed to extract a confession. And I'm sorry, I have not been watching my lights. The red light is now on. It's probably been on for a while. And in the absence of any further questions, I'm ready to sit
Thank
down.
Thank you very much.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Donna L. Hines, Assistant State Public Defender, representing Jeremy T. Greer.
Good morning.
Maybe you should lower the microphone, counsel. Thank you.
I'm Donna Hintz, and I appear on behalf of the respondent in this case, Jeremy Greer. I'm going to be asking the court to do three things today. The first is to reinforce the rule that we presently have in this state, that any statement obtained during a post-polygraph interview that is closely connected to the polygraph examination itself should be held inadmissible. That is the current state of the rule. I'm going to ask you to uphold that. Secondly, in the context of that rule, I'm going to ask you to respond to the question that the Court of Appeals certified to this court, and that is I'm going to be asking the court to maintain that when a defendant or a suspect is told that he failed a post-polygraph interview, and that is done almost immediately prior to the interview, told that he failed a polygraph examination, and that is done almost immediately prior to the subsequent interview, that the two should be considered so closely related that the subsequent statement should be held inadmissible, just like the results of the polygraph examination are. Third, what I'm going to be asking the court to do is something that I freely admit was not raised in the brief. I'm going to be asking the court, if it concludes that the statement in this case was not closely related to the polygraph examination, and if the court elects to reject the present rule in Wisconsin to change that rule, I'm then going to be asking the court to uphold the trial court ruling on the alternative ground that it was involuntary. This was not raised in my brief. I think that was definitely an omission by me. I should have raised this as an alternative ground. Voluntariness is a question of law for the court to decide. All of the facts have already been decided by the trial court, and I think this court is in as good a position as anybody else to take a look at the voluntariness of the statement.
So you would not send it back?
I would not send it back because I believe this is purely a question of law since all the findings of fact have been made. I believe looking, however, at the trial court ruling that the trial court did not consider all of the totality of the facts in analyzing the voluntariness of the statement below. And I reached that conclusion after reviewing the transcript of the proceedings in preparation for this argument. And I regret that I did not raise this in my brief. But I'd like to begin with a certification by the Court of Appeals. The reason why the court asked you to review this case, and I will just read that, the short statement. The question was, is a police statement that the defendant failed a polygraph examination made immediately before a post-polygraph interview so significant that it overcomes the other factors distinguishing the polygraph examination from the interview and causes the interview to be so closely related to the polygraph examination that statements made in the interview must be suppressed? That is the question that the Court of Appeals sent to you. The Court of Appeals was not asking you to reject the present rule. That's the State's request, not the Court of Appeals. Under current...
Can I interrupt for a minute? Did Mr. Greer hear that statement? Do I understand correctly that he testified that he didn't hear the exchange between the officers?
He testified he did not hear that. The finding of the trial court, however, that was made in his presence, and that the only purpose the trial court found for making the statement for the officer who did the polygraph examination, Detective Hargrove, to tell Detective Williams, who was going to conduct the interview, that Mr. Greer had failed the examination but was now ready to tell the truth.
Well, isn't it significant that he didn't hear it? I mean, if he testified himself he never heard this, isn't that very significant not only on the way you presented the issue but also on an issue of voluntariness?
The defendants testified that he knew the two officers were talking. He said he could not hear their conversation, but he believed that they were talking about him. He had previously been told that he failed the examination. I think his belief was that they were talking about this and that the one officer was telling the other whether or not he specifically heard the conversation. The trial judge found, as a matter of fact, that Mr. Greer was aware that the officers knew that he had failed or that he had been told that he failed the polygraph examination.
Did Judge Crawford find that the statements were voluntary?
The judge did make a statement, did make a finding that the statements were voluntary. Primarily what he was relying upon, though, was in his discussion of voluntariness, he looked to the fact that Mr. Greer had been told, according to the judge, the finding of fact again, been told by Officer Hargrove that if he played the detectives, if he was not honest with them, that they would see that he got 120 years. But if he cooperated and admitted his responsibility, that he, Officer Hargrove, would see that he got 5 years probation. It was that factor that the judge looked at in saying he did not think that his will was overborne in making his statement. That was the context in which the judge made his voluntariness finding. However, the judge also made findings that Mr. Greer was told that he had failed the polygraph examination and that the only reason to tell him that was to try and pry a confession out of him. So I think what we have is a combination of factors here that really point to the fact that Mr. Greer was not making a voluntary statement. And I think Mr. Greer's own words point that out. When he was asked what he thought when he was told that if he kept playing the officers, he would get 120 years, but if he admitted his guilt, he could get 5 years probation, they said, "What did you think about that?" And Mr. Greer said, "Well, I thought I'm not doing no 120 years for something I didn't do. I'd rather have 5 years probation." And this is just in the context of having been told that he's failed a polygraph examination. And as Justice Abramson pointed out, he's never been told that that's inadmissible. In fact, the form indicates it's going to be conveyed to the district attorney's office, and I think a reasonable person in this position would believe that it was going to be used against him. So here he is, a young man, 1 year over his, 1 month past his 18th birthday, being interrogated by police, who's telling him he can get 120 years or probation if he confesses. And he knows there's a polygraph that he believes can probably be used against him. What chance does he have at trial? He's going to be trying to cut the best deal he can, which brings up the question of reliability of his statement. There are false confessions that are made.
Well, why doesn't all of this go to the voluntariness of the confession rather than the polygraph itself?
It does go to the voluntariness of confession, but I believe this Court has set forth a rule that is a reasonable rule to help weed out false confessions, to ensure that the statements that do come in at trial are reliable. I believe it's reasonable for us to say...
Doesn't the voluntariness... Excuse me for interrupting, because I'm not sure if you catch my drift. Doesn't the rule, the well-established case law in the state on voluntariness really alleviate the need for eliminating the old rule? What sense does the old rule make, the one that the state is asking us to overrule?
I think a voluntary statement can still be unreliable. And I think that there are some procedures and tactics that the police may use to induce a confession that even while it may be a voluntary exercise of the person's free will not necessarily be reliable. And so we should not, as a matter of public policy, allow those practices.
Of course. But that's the present case law regarding statements. What does the presence of a polygraph have to do with voluntariness? I mean, here you're bringing in a factor. The old rule brings in a factor, the present rule brings in the factor of a polygraph. And it says if any statement made while you're given a polygraph is inadmissible, while you're taking a polygraph. But what does that polygraph have to do with the question of whether or not the defendant's statement was voluntary or not?
I guess I'm not sure I understand the question. It seems to me that...
Well, I guess I don't understand the basis for the present rule, because... I mean, the basis seems to set up a presumption that the presence of a polygraph creates an involuntary statement.
This Court has never said that. This Court has never said that the reason polygraph evidence is inadmissible is because it's unreliable.
No, I'm not talking about the evidence of polygraph. I'm not saying that the... I'm not articulating it as well as I would like, but... What I'm saying is that just because the present rule says, regardless of the voluntariness of the statement, regardless if 10 angels were to testify that the answers given to the polygraph examiner were in fact voluntary, nevertheless, because those answers were given when he was strapped up to a polygraph machine, they can't be allowed in. That makes no sense to me.
I think the answer to that is that there's a perception that the polygraph examination and using the polygraph examination to elicit a confession is a coercive tactic, and that we should not be approving that type of
but
conduct.
But polygraphs are not given unless the defendant volunteers to take them.
That's true. But I believe a defendant placed in the position of being asked by the officer if he'll take a polygraph will oftentimes feel compelled to do so, on the theory that if he doesn't, they'll believe that he's guilty anyhow.
But doesn't that again go to the issue of voluntariness?
Yes, it does. But it also goes to the issue of whether or not it's an appropriate police tactic and whether or not it's one that we wish to approve, wish to sanction, or whether it's one that we think may lead to false confessions. So as a matter of public policy, we should not admit those statements, regardless of whether or not they may be voluntary, because we don't know whether or not they can be trusted, whether or not they're trustworthy. It can be voluntary, but not trustworthy. And I think this goes to the trustworthiness of the statement, not just the voluntariness of
it. But you're asking us to make that determination as a matter of law across the board, rather than letting the jury decide. And I think this goes to Justice Babich's questions or line of questions, rather than letting the jury decide the credibility or trustworthiness of the statement.
In this context, yes. We don't allow the jury to decide whether a statement that is beaten out of somebody is trustworthy. I think this is, while more of a psychological ploy, is on the same level of that. The question is whether it's a tactic that may lead to false confessions and untrustworthy confessions, that we should be careful about that, should not allow that tactic to be used.
So the use of a polygraph as an investigative tool, even if it is overtly and intentionally used to get a confession, is illegal?
I'm not saying it's illegal. What I'm saying is that it is not an investigatory tool when it's used to obtain a confession. If they give a person a polygraph, don't tell them the results and use that as a guide for their investigation, whether or not they continue in the same line of this suspect or whether they decide, well, maybe we should look elsewhere. That's an investigatory tool. That's very proper. But to tell this person, you failed the test, now do you want to tell us the truth, is very different. That's using the test to try and obtain a confession. And I think that that's akin to lying about the law, because the perception is that the person is going to have that used against them at trial. They're never told that's not the case. And so the perception is it's going to be used against them. So if this is going to come out, and it's different from the ordinary evidence, because this encompasses the whole issue in the case. The issue that the jury is looking at is, did this defendant commit the crime? If the polygraph is accurate and believed by the jury, then they're going to conclude that this person who they're told failed the polygraph, that this person then must have committed that crime. It's not a piece of the puzzle. It's the whole thing. It's not like telling a defendant, we've got your fingerprints at the scene of the crime, whether that is truthful or deceptive, because the defendant can know whether or not his fingerprints were there and can have a way of challenging those. The defendant can know that he's telling the truth, but if there's a polygraph, a lie detector that the jury's going to be told says he lied, how is he going to fight that in front of a jury? So this is the type of thing that could lead a suspect, particularly one who's been told that he can get 120 years or 5 years probation, to give a statement to cut the best deal he can under the circumstances.
So to clarify my question, you are asking for a bright line rule that a polygraph used in this way to elicit a confession, that police tactic is unconstitutional or illegal.
I'm asking the court to say that if they use a polygraph examination to elicit a confession, that under the present rule it will be so closely connected that it should be held inadmissible.
Don't you think some of the dangers that you're talking about are offset by the giving of the Miranda warnings at the front end of this? Doesn't that seem to make a difference?
No. In fact, I think it increases it. One of the warnings is that anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. I think the fact that you then take a polygraph and the results are termed to be untruthful tells you.
You're also told about your right to an attorney, your right to remain silent. You're given a lot more than anything you say can be used against you.
That's true, but once a defendant indicates that he will take a polygraph, and it is true that he's told he can stop it, but that actually will take pretty good force of will for somebody to stop in the middle and say, okay, Mr. Police Officer, Mr. Polygraph Examiner, I'm done. I don't want to answer any more questions. It's possible, and it is their right, but I think that's difficult for someone to do, particularly somebody who's 18 years old.
Could I ask you to comment on this 120-year threat, 5-year probation promise? Suppose, just take the polygraph out of the picture entirely. How would that play out if there were no polygraph at all?
Well, there is case law that says that promises of leniency alone may not be sufficient to overcome a finding that a statement is voluntary. I think that there, in this case, whether or not that is sufficient, I think the whole combination of factors in this case, which is what we're to look at in voluntariness, it's the totality of the circumstances, I think does render this statement involuntary. A statement, it's sort of a threat-promise combination, because the threat is that you're subject to 120 years here, and these officers are going to be upset if you don't cooperate, and they're going to try and see that you get all of that. Versus, but if you cooperate and admit you did this, I'll see that you get 5 years probation. You know, it's a carrot and a stick. And the defendant doesn't know the reality, whether or not this is even possible. It's the law has said that when officers lie about facts, that that is viewed less onerously than if they lie about the law in the context of obtaining a statement. And this 120 years versus 5 years probation is close to being misleading upon the law if it's not outright misleading. But when combined with the fact that the defendant's told that he failed the polygraph and the person who's going to conduct his post-polygraph interview is also told that, this provides a coercive effect for him to just make a statement, to cooperate, to try and get the benefit that he's been promised, the 5 years probation. Of course, we don't know if anybody would go to bat for Mr. Greer at all in terms of sentencing because the trial has not taken place, but it seems unlikely. Obviously, the police officer is in no position to bind the district attorney, but Mr. Greer wasn't told that either. He was just told that the officer would see that he got 5 years probation rather than 120 years.
The rule that you're asking for would require the law enforcement agency to withhold the results of the polygraph from the defendant in order to preserve the admissibility of any post-polygraph statement?
Yes.
And why does that make sense? Or why is that legally required?
It's not legally required at the present time.
But that's what you're asking us to find or hold.
Yes. I'm asking you to find as a matter of law that once the post-polygraph statement or the polygraph examination is used to elicit a confession, once there's a finding that that's what was done, that that automatically means that it should be inadmissible. And I think that that's a reasonable solution, because if police officers really want to use this to investigate, all they need is the results. They don't have to tell the defendant what the results are. They only need the results. That will aid them in their investigation and going in various ways.
That's just not true. Law enforcement and prosecutors use polygraph results as negotiating tools every day, in all sorts of different contexts. And they tell the defendant whether he's unrepresented and in custody pre-charging or whether he's represented in custody post-charging. They tell the defendant, and in that context it would be, and the defendant's attorney, what the results are in order to negotiate the case. That's a very common practice.
I think you're asking us
to find that that's illegal somehow.
I'm asking you to find that if they use the polygraph to elicit a confession, that it won't be admissible at trial. If they want to use it for other purposes, that's fine. If they want to use it for a negotiating tactic and somebody wants to negotiate back based on that, that's fine. If the defense knows that it's going to be inadmissible and still wants to negotiate, that's okay. But I'm saying it can't come in court. You've now tainted the process and it can't come in. That's the risk that the officers run when they reveal the results, that there's really no reason to reveal the results to them. The officers don't have to do that. You're saying that the district attorney may do that for negotiation purposes. If they want to do that, well, then it's not to obtain a confession at that point. It's past that.
What is the law that requires this result that you're asking for?
Due process. That as a matter of due process, this is a questionable tactic that may lead to false confessions. It's a practice that should not be encouraged. Wisconsin has had this rule for over 20 years now, and I don't see that there is a wealth of cases that are out there where this arises, where there's some critical confession that doesn't come in.
What part of due process requires this?
Fundamental fairness. To the defendant.
You're making a substantive due process argument? That it's fundamentally unfair to try a defendant based on this evidence.
I think this is akin to voluntariness, that there's, as a matter of due process, that this type of tactic should not be used and that it is coercive and so should not be approved.
What is the legal support for that?
I believe it's due process.
But I have a case that says
I don't have one. I'm sorry, off the top of my head.
Oh, Montana would do. What about Montana? What about the Craig case?
That's true. Montana jurisdiction does not, as Wisconsin does not authorize the introduction of polygraph evidence. And they've also said that they believe it's improper for police to use this tactic to elicit a confession. And I think that when we're looking at the tactics, it's very hard to talk about them separate from the voluntariness rule. And I think implicit in the Montana decision is that they think this tactic renders the statement involuntary. But they did not say that, but I think that's implicit. And I think that's pretty much what this court could say, too, the use of the statement, the polygraph failing, is different than other tactics that the police use that might be deceptive.
But as a matter of fact, statements acquired or procured under these circumstances are not involuntary.
I think that's a question for the court to determine. I don't think that's
a given. We let juries determine facts.
We don't allow the jury to determine the voluntariness of the statement initially. That's determined by the trial court.
Also, continuing on in this, and then I have another question, but this has got me thinking here more. Well, let's assume here for purposes of this case that we did not have the threat of 120 years versus 5 years probation. And what I'm trying to do is parse out what the circumstances are that we're going to, that you want us to say is bad, illegal. So you have the police saying to the defendant, "You lied. You failed the polygraph test." Period. Now there are, the police could be telling the truth. He did in fact fail, or they could be lying. He passed, but they're telling the truth. I take it you are saying under either situation, the statement should not be allowed in.
That's correct.
And what is it, absent the 120 years, absent that, that is so coercive and so unfair about this that it goes so far as to violate due process?
I think it's the nature of the polygraph itself. I think polygraph is unique. The polygraph tests whether or not the defendant is telling the truth about the entire incident. I can't imagine that there would be a polygraph given in a criminal case in which the question would not be asked, in an armed robbery case, did you rob this person at gunpoint? Did you take his money? It goes to the entire situation. It's not a part of the case. It's the fundamental fact that the jury is asked to define as a whole. And because of that, a defendant is placed in a terrible position. When he's told that he failed the polygraph and he knows he's telling the truth, he's not told that it's not going to be admissible, so he thinks the jury's going to hear this. And what chance does he have to challenge a lie detector? Something that I think is a matter of common occurrence, the general public probably thinks is reliable. Now, I think that there are a lot of studies that call the reliability of polygraphs into question, but the general public hears, is that it's used in employment situations. It's used in security situations. We hear how the FBI uses it, the CIA uses it, and we hear how, they're wondering now what they can do to be above their security when they find a spy that has gotten past their polygraph. But it's not uncommon for everyday people to think, I believe, that this is a useful tool and that this tells the truth. It's a lie detector. Now, a defendant is going to think that the ordinary person on his jury is going to believe that if he lied when he said he didn't commit this crime, that he's guilty. And how does he combat that?
Okay, that leads me to the question that I was originally going to ask, which is, what's wrong with Mr. Becker's posit of a curing instruction? He would expressly tell the jury that the polygraph test is not reliable, that the law does not recognize it, and it's to be considered only on the question of credibility and not on the question of whether he was in fact lying. What's wrong with that?
I think it asks a jury to do more than what they may be capable of doing. It is asking them to ignore the pink elephant in the corner. There are some situations, I think of the juror voir dire cases, where we say that there's some situations where we can't necessarily expect that a juror will be able to overcome prior information that they have. And so we just say that those prospective jurors should not be allowed on the jury, just to be safe. And I think that this is akin to that we're asking the jurors to ignore what is almost a matter to them, perhaps, of common sense. And while they may try to do so, I think it's asking more than what we should of them. And it's asking more than what we should place on the defendant as a burden of whether or not he may be convicted on the basis of the fact that the jury is unable to totally disregard the pink elephant that they've seen in the corner. I don't think in all cases that a curative instruction or a limiting instruction is sufficient. And I think this is one of them because of the unique nature of a polygraph. It is something that isn't just part of the case. It is the whole case.
But how, if the decision to submit to a polygraph is made knowingly and voluntarily, as this one was, how can the things that are said during the course of the polygraph be deemed to be involuntary and therefore per se unreliable? That just doesn't square.
Well, this is what's said after the polygraph is over and after he's been told he failed the polygraph. That's It was at that point that Mr. Greer made an inculpatory statement after he was told he lied, after he was told he failed the polygraph, and after he was told that if he didn't confess, he could get 120 years.
But the rule about the inadmissibility of post-polygraph statements is derives from their connection to the polygraph. And we're being asked to abrogate that rule for not only post-polygraph statements, but statements made during the course of the polygraph. And so I'm just not tracking on your legal argument here. If the polygraph was undergone voluntarily and knowingly based upon a fully adequate waiver, how can what is said during the polygraph be legally deemed to be involuntary and therefore those statements per se unreliable for purposes of their admission to the jury?
Well, the present rule doesn't keep out polygraph evidence because it's involuntary. It keeps out polygraph evidence presumably because this court questioned the reliability without saying it's unreliable.
The present rule keeps out polygraph results because they are unreliable or not sufficiently reliable to be admitted across the board.
Yes, it keeps out polygraph results. It keeps out any indication that a polygraph was even taken, any polygraph evidence. And the present rule ties the statement made in connection with the polygraph to the rule for why the polygraph evidence itself is kept out, presumably reliability.
But has that been done on the basis of the supposition that what is said during the polygraph can't be relied upon, or just the science, the technology can't be relied upon?
This court has never said that the polygraph is unreliable, nor has it said it's reliable so that it can be admitted without conditions. It's sort of...
As I read the case, it says, this is State versus Dean, it says that the science, the technology has not risen to the level such that we could consider it reliable and therefore admissible. But that refers to the science, the expertise of the expert and the technology and science of polygraphs, not whether or not the statements that are made by the defendant after a knowing and voluntary waiver of his right to remain silent and his right to counsel, etc., are themselves voluntary, inadmissible, and subject to the normal test for reliability that a jury would apply.
And I'm suggesting that I believe that the polygraph, a statement obtained following a polygraph, is also subject to a question of reliability, not scientific reliability, but reliability based on whether or not it was coerced from the defendant. Coerced in the sense not that he didn't voluntarily, willingly make the statement, but coerced in the sense that he felt in a box and felt that this was the best way out of the box once he'd been told he failed and believes the jury's going to hear that. That this is his way out is to try and make the best deal he can. That I think the risk is that we will have false confessions if we utilize a statement that you failed a polygraph to elicit a confession. That doesn't mean that polygraphs can't be used. It only means that you can't use a polygraph to elicit a confession. That's the bright line. You can't use it to elicit a confession. It can be used as a tool otherwise for investigation, but that it's improper otherwise.
Counsel, Justice Sykes said to you, how can you object to this confession after he's been fully and adequately warned and there's a good waiver? Do you agree with that?
I don't believe he's fully and adequately warned because he isn't told what the polygraph can and cannot be used for. And I think that's critical.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Assistant Attorney General Becker.
I just want to make responses to two things. The first is this attempt to raise for the first time on this appeal, after it was not raised in the Court of Appeals, nor raised in the briefs in this court, the question of voluntariness. That's just not the way the system works. Obviously, you haven't, this hasn't been briefed for you. You've heard one side presented. I have 5 minutes, and I don't want to spend it all on this, and I couldn't if I wanted to, because I haven't gone back and researched the law of voluntariness. Among other things, she talks about the difference between misrepresenting facts and misrepresenting law. I don't know what the law is on that. So I don't think there's any question but that this comes way too late in the process. But let me just add as a footnote to that this concern. My instincts tell me that that statement, upon which I think she primarily relies in contending that this was involuntary, namely, you're going to get 120 years if you keep messing around with us, and we'll get you 5 years probation or whatever this promise was if you cooperate and confess. I'm not so sure that that statement was ever made, and my instincts tell me it probably wasn't. We never heard from the polygraph examiner. We did hear defendant's testimony in all kinds of other respects that the trial court rejected. Defendant said he never got Miranda warnings that first day that he was brought in. Officer testified he did. The trial court believed the officer. He testified that he was physically grabbed. I think on the first occasion, the officer testified he wasn't. The judge, I'm pretty sure the judge made a finding on that one also. I know there were at least two factual findings where he disbelieved the defendant and believed the officer. For some reason, he apparently credited the defendant's statement about this threat promise, but he had never heard from the officer. And the reason he didn't hear from the officer is because at the beginning of the hearing, the DA explained he's on military leave. And I suggest to you that before the question of voluntariness can be fully explored, it turned out to basically be a moot question once the judge found that it was voluntary. It became a moot question, even with believing the defendant. It became a moot question as to whether you needed to believe the defendant or whether there was contrary testimony that should be believed. So the officer was never brought in. The officer who was out on military leave, who conducted the polygraph and supposedly made the statements, was never brought in. So I don't think the question of voluntariness as a legal matter is properly before the court, and as a factual matter, I think in fairness to the state, at the very most that could be ordered here would be a remand for further fact-finding on the subject if that statement were found to, or if the judge were found to be in error in concluding that statement didn't render the defendant's statement involuntary.
Isn't that needed under your statement of the law, too? Because you're relying on the application of involuntary.
Yeah. I wouldn't have any objection to I don't know where you're going to go. But assuming that you do not reaffirm existing law, there may well be, and this will be a judgment you'll have to make, because I can't make it because I don't know what you're going to write as what the law should be. But if the law should be that this should be tested basically like all other statements and this should be thrown into the voluntariness-involuntariness equation, it might well be appropriate for you to send it back down and say, basically start over again now knowing what the law is and take a new look at the involuntariness question and basically realize that you can't exclude it on the grounds you presently excluded it, namely that it violates this rule on the admissibility of statements made in connection with polygraph examinations, because that I'm assuming you've thrown out and now you've created some new standard, and maybe the standard is simply voluntariness. That's what I'm suggesting. But in that situation, it might well be appropriate. You'll have to make that judgment.
Well, but if voluntariness is a question of law, do you dispute that?
No, I don't dispute that. But
why would we have to send it back?
Well, among other things, I think you have to send it back. I think you have to send it back for another reason, for what I suggested earlier. The state's got to get a fair chance to get its case before the trier of fact. We didn't have that because our officer that would have contradicted the defendant, and my instincts tell me he would have. I don't have any offer of proof or anything to that point, but that we've got to have a fair chance at presenting that testimony. That's really all I have to say about that. The other thing I wanted to respond to, and I don't know how much time I have left, but basically the court elicited from my opponent the fact that what she's looking for is that basically a rule that says if you tell the guy that he flunked the polygraph and then you get a statement as a result of doing that, it's inadmissible. Well, I'll repeat what I said in my earlier argument. There is one case out there that would support that approach, although not necessarily grounded in due process.
You can finish the sentence, Mr.
Well, I've already said what I wanted to say about Craig, that stands basically alone. I've cited in my brief all kinds of cases that go the other way. And with my red light on, I guess that's where I have to stop.
Thank you, Mr. Becker, and thank you, Ms. Hines, for your argument in State v. Jeremy Greer, and thank you for agreeing to come early. 01-2591-CR, State v. Greer, is closed. The court is in recess until oral argument on Thursday and has open administrative cuts tomorrow.
145.
Pardon me. 145 for the court to reconvene.